Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Jonathan Cortez, the producer and host of today's episode. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Yarimad Bonilla and Dr. Marisol Lebron about their new edited anthology, Aftershocks of Disaster, Puerto Rico Before and After the Storm, published by Haymarket Books just this month, and in fact, this interview is happening one day after the NYU Latinx Project book launch and panel. And so I am so excited to be on the heels of that conversation. And I will be sure to link the video to that panel in the description of the New Books Network. Before we get started, I'm going to introduce our guests in alphabetical order by last name. Dr. Bonilla is a political anthropologist and professor at the City University of New York, whose work currently focuses on the political, economic, and social aftermath of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, for which she is a 2018-2020 Carnegie Fellow. Bonilla's first book, Non-Sovereign Futures, French Caribbean Politics in the Wake of Disenchantment, published in 2015 by the University of Chicago Press, examines how contemporary activists in the French Caribbean island of Guadeloupe imagine and contest the limits of post-colonial sovereignty. She has received many awards for her work across disciplines, including those from the National Science Foundation, the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, and the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute at Harvard University. Dr. Marisol Lebron is currently assistant professor in the Department of American and Latino Studies, at the University of Texas at Austin. During the 2019-2020 academic year, Lebron will be a faculty fellow at Harvard University's Charles Warren Center for Studies in American History. Her work focuses on spatial inequality, policing, violence, and protest. Her 2019 published book, Policing Life and Death, Race, Violence, and Resistance in Puerto Rico by the University of California Press, examines the growth and punitive governance in contemporary Puerto Rico. Both Yarimal and Marisol are leading voices on questions of the Caribbean and Latinx politics. Both are also principal contributors to what is now known as the Puerto Rican Syllabus, along with their colleague, Sara Molinari, which is a list of collaboratively sourced resources for teaching and learning about the current economic crisis in Puerto Rico. And I will also plug that they both also have amazing and aspirational websites that I think everyone should check out. So thank you all so much for both being on an interview with us today, and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. I just wanted to add that with Puerto Rico Syllabus, there's an additional collaborator with it, which is Isabel Guzardo from Rutgers University as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much for adding that. So just to get started, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourselves. What are your personal and academic backgrounds? How you came to study what you study? Marisol, would you like to go first?
Yeah, we were just actually pointing at each other over who was going to go first over here. So, a little bit about my background. I'm trained as an American Studies scholar and trained in Latino studies as well. I did my undergrad work at Oberlin College, and I worked with Gina Perez there, who is an amazing anthropologist and Latino Studies scholar. And really kind of got me super interested in thinking through these questions around empire and race and Puerto Rico in relation to American studies. So really thinking about Puerto Rico as a contemporary site in American studies. One of the problems with often how we conceptualize Puerto Rico in relation to American studies is that it's seen as this object of the past, right? So it's always related to 1898 in this moment of kind of imperialist frenzy. And then it's as if Puerto Rico is no longer relevant to American studies. And so working with Gina, I became really interested in how we can think about an endurance of American empire in Puerto Rico. And I think that's something that also, when I came to NYU to do my PhD in American studies, I was able to do and had a lot of support for in the program there, and worked with Arlene Davila there, who I was really excited to have the launch event with at the Latinx Project last night. So that kind of question around empire and the kind of enduring legacies of these imperial practices is something that informs all of my work. It's something that comes through in my first book, In Policing Life and Death, and something that really comes through in the book that Yadimar and I edited as well.
Yeah, so for me, I was born in Puerto Rico, although my mom says I can decide if I'm Island Rican or Diaspora Rican because I've lived equal amounts of time on both. And I went to school at the University of Puerto Rico. My major was in Caribbean studies. And at the time, I really wanted to be a journalist. And with no guidance from any professional or expert, I decided that to be a journalist, I should not study communications, which is what you would have thought, but I decided to instead do Caribbean studies and get my master's degree in Latin American studies because I had this dream of being like a foreign correspondent and stationed in Nicaragua or something. And I was really interested in, whereas Marisol was trying to think about Puerto Rico in relationship to the United States, my interest was really thinking about it in relationship to Latin America and to the Caribbean, because coming from Puerto Rico, I felt like we were too obsessed with the United States. But then as I went to get my master's at the University of New Mexico, where I began taking courses in anthropology, and I thought, well, this is like a foreign correspondent. You just got to, you know, go and study people and places that you're interested in. And so I decided to get my PhD in anthropology, and I went to the University of Chicago to work with Michelle Ralph Trio, the late Michelle Ralph Trio, who was, you know, and remains one of the most important figures in Caribbean studies, and undoubtedly within anthropology, but, you know, broadly speaking as well. So so I worked with him, and part of what he encouraged me to do was to move out beyond Puerto Rico to try to think about the questions that I was interested in terms of imperialism, sovereignty, social movements, in a different context. So my first book is about the French Caribbean and about the relationship of the French Overseas Department to the French metropole, and how has, you know, departmentalization, full annexation into the French nation, how has that solved or not solved the colonial relationship that, you know, people feel in Guadeloupe? I talk about social movements, I talk about labor unions, and I talk about how folks in the Caribbean, particularly in places like Guadeloupe and Puerto Rico that are not independent nation states, how they imagine the questions of sovereignty and the challenges of sovereignty for post-colonial societies in the Caribbean and beyond.
Well, thank you. Thank you both so much. It's really fascinating to hear how you all think about Puerto Rico from different perspectives and have come to think about Puerto Rico from different perspectives. Now, turning to the book, I was wondering if you all can tell us a bit about the development of the anthology. How did it come together? How did you two come to be its co-editors? And maybe perhaps a little further down in the conversation, how you all decided to organize the book in the sections that were presented, right? So you have openings, narrating the trauma, representing the disaster, capitalizing on the crisis, and transforming Puerto Rico.
Yeah, so the book began as a conference that I organized at Rutgers University. I was approached by one of the associate vice presidents there. They wanted to do something in the wake of Hurricane Maria for the 1 year anniversary. And so I remain very grateful to her because I think that I was still, getting my bearings from everything that had happened, and it might not have occurred to me to take this on. So she was very generous in funding this conference. And part of what I wanted to do, given the place and the audience, was that I really wanted to bring voices from Puerto Rico to speak on these issues and to move beyond just traditionally academic voices. So I sought out journalists, activists, artists. We started the conference as we do the book with a play, because I felt like there were all these different entry points that were necessary for thinking about Maria, and that there were ways in which the narrative tools of the social sciences or even of the humanities fell short. So that was really something that was, part of the initial conference, which was grouped around panels with the themes that you mentioned. Although then at the conference, one of the participants said, "This should be a book." And I'm like, "Oh, I guess it should." So again, I'm grateful to her for envisioning that. And that was Sandra Rodriguez Coto. And so I approached several presses, and some of them, said that they weren't interested, that they didn't think that anthologies sold well, that people wanted single authored books, that was easier to market. But, I really felt that this was an important conversation, an important contribution. And so Haymarket Press, who had published Naomi Klein's book,
Battle for Paradise.
The Battle for Paradise. They agreed, and in conversation with them, they said, "Well, we could get this out in 1 year, which is insane for coming from the academic publishing world." And so I said, "Well, I know just the person to work with me on this." And so Marisol and I had already been in conversation. I mean, we're in permanent conversation about our research and work together on Puerto Rico syllabus. And we had already talked about doing an edited volume from, related to Puerto Rico syllabus. And so I asked her if she would be willing to do this instead. And she stepped on. And so we had a crazy couple of months putting this all together.
Yeah, I think, so I came in, I wasn't able to attend the Rutgers conference. And so I kind of came in after, and I was really scared, but also excited about Yadimar's invitations, as I often am. But I'm always grateful at the end of them, because it was this really, I think, daunting task that we had in front of us, which was basically to get everything together for this book within, a 6 month span. So at this time,
less.
So at this time last year, actually, was when we were beginning the conversations about how we were going to turn this into an edited volume. So, I mean, the kind of time crunch that it took, I think, was for us as folks working in traditional academic disciplines, really kind of head spinning, but I think was really exciting. Both of us are really committed to doing public scholarship projects. So we have both really, I think, especially in the past 2 years, really been challenging ourselves to produce work that is more publicly accessible, that is speaking to a kind of urgency, right, in a way that a traditional scholarly monograph can't always do, right? And I thought that having a chance to kind of bring all of these folks together and having it be distributed by Haymarket, right, having it be kind of distributed by US Left Press was a really important kind of move for us to, I think, centralize these voices is important for these progressive and left struggles in the U.S. as well as globally and throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. So we put to work, and our contributors were amazing. We did have to do a little coaxing, but for the most part, everyone was really awesome in terms of getting their submissions in. So, I mean, it's a testament to people's commitment to really diving into this theme that we have over 30 contributors. And this book came out in the span of less than a year, I think, because everyone felt that this was so critical and so urgent to really pull together on.
Yeah. And I, you know, I'm really grateful to Haymarket because they've also have priced it, you know, at a very accessible price point. And so I think, you know, people can purchase it and mm-hmm. feel comfortable also assigning it in classes. It's something, you know, students can afford. And it's also going to be distributed in Puerto Rico, where it's also, you know, an accessible price point there. So I think, you know, I've been reflecting on this as we've been doing the opening events, you know, where I hear so many people saying, oh, this is so great for the classroom. And, you know, it's true that it's so hard to find readings that are an accessible tone and an appropriate length for an undergrad mm-hmm. class and for an audience that is not a specialist in Puerto Rico. And so I'm hoping that, you know, that we can show that there is an audience for these kinds of books, you know, and that there is interest in hearing different voices.
Yeah, thank you both. And I like the point about accessibility, because as you all mentioned, you all have you'll have photographers, artists, journalists, people speaking about theater, media, poetry, technology, and all of these are different ways of accessing, right? Accessing the histories of Puerto Rico and what happened before and after Maria. And so I want to talk more about this idea of public scholarship and access, and maybe we can loop in here your work on the PR syllabus. Can you all talk more about the syllabus, how that came together, and maybe a little bit more about what its function is?
So the PR syllabus, it emerged, I see its emergence as a conversation that I had with my colleague Isar Godreau in Puerto Rico at the time of the university strike there. Mm-hmm. And so she was telling me, oh, you know, I'm in the U.S. and she's in Puerto Rico and I'm trying to figure out how I can support the strike. And she's like, you know, here we're so caught up in, you know, being on the picket lines and having meetings, but we're really struggling to try to get our head around the debt and to try to get our head around, you know, the broader, you know, austerity regime in which the budget cuts to the university are, you know, embedded. And so it would be really great to just have like a list of resources. And so as Marisol can attest, I always like escalate things to the next level. And so it was supposed to be a list of resources. And I'm like, oh, let's turn it into like a crowdsourced like public syllabus. And I know, you know, Marisol Lebron, she's really great on Twitter and she had a blog and she would be like a perfect person to, you know, engage in this public scholarly engaged, you know, initiative. So I reached out to Marisol and I'm sure she was, again, excited and afraid.
It's like a constant undercurrent in our scholarly relationship.
Yeah, but so, you know, I reached out with the idea and it started as a Google Doc of links. And then I'm like, oh, we should make it a WordPress site, you know, just like an advanced Google Doc. And it's just mushroomed into this big site that we love and that a lot of people I know use and value. And we get emails all the time from people who appreciate it. Although at the same time, we don't sleep at night stressed out about keeping it updated because, you know, we undertook this before Hurricane Maria. And since the hurricane, you know, and all everything that was already unfolding with the debt crisis, but now all that's going on with FEMA and the recovery, all the different interests in Puerto Rico right now, it's really become a very large project. We have multiple collaborators and we've been fundraising and trying to figure out how to sustain it, because one of the problems with these kinds of social scholarship, public scholarship is that, you know, people do it in a volunteer basis in response to a moment. And it's really hard to sustain those projects and institutionalize them over time. So that's what we're trying to figure out, how to make it a sustainable project that we can keep going while at the same time doing our other work.
Yeah, I think one of the things that makes the PR syllabus like really unique and really challenging in a lot of ways, but also incredibly rewarding is the fact that, and this is something that we were discussing last night at the launch event, is like, what do you do when the crisis is ongoing, right? The crisis hasn't ended. So for us, we wanted to have this amazing, accessible public resource on how to understand the debt crisis, because we really felt that that was there's a lot of noise out there about the debt, right? It was very difficult to cut through what was kind of, you know, in a lot of ways, pro-austerity government propaganda apologies, right? Versus kind of what was a critical perspective and a perspective that took into account kind of the complex history that gave rise to this debt crisis, right? It didn't just pop out of nowhere in 2015, right? This has been a longstanding structural crisis that is very much embedded within a colonial system, right, in Puerto Rico. So for us, we were really looking for these resources that could be attentive and that we could direct people to. But that means that, like, as this crisis continues to unfold, we have it's constantly changing on the ground, both in terms of what are the kinds of things that the Fiscal Control Board is doing? What are these new Title III hearings? What are the new kind of demands that bondholders are making, right? Versus what are the ways in which activists or artists are now responding to this crisis, given different exigencies on how to deal with it, right? And so it's been kind of a challenge for us to kind of keep up with that. So Yarimar joked about us not like sleeping at night, right, and stuff like that, because I think there is a pressure where we do consider ourselves really trying to provide these resources and trying to provide folks with kind of reliable and accessible information on the debt. Because the other reason why this was a really important project for us, and I think this speaks to kind of our political commitments, our kind of pride in that this is all women-led kind of project, right, is that this is a lot of the ways that the debt gets dealt with is in these like super sterile, like masculinist kind of economic hard rational logics that dismiss like the very real effects that the debt has on people's lives, right, through this obfuscation of numbers and statistics and responsibility and things like that. And so we really tried to also look for sources that were outside of that, that were very attentive to kind of the lived reality of the debt and the ways in which the debt was kind of compounding people's lived vulnerabilities, right? But also the way in which these groups that are incredibly vulnerable and marginalized within Puerto Rico are also at the forefront of the most vibrant kind of resistance to this kind of austerity and state violence. So that's something that we felt like was really missing and that was really unique for us as kind of a collective that was working on this, that was all women-led, that was kind of across rank, right? So the fact that we have someone who's a full professor and we have folks who are grad students that are working on this and we all are working on this equally and we all bring something kind of unique and different to these conversations, right? So thinking about our other two collaborators, Sarah and Isabel. Isabel brings this amazing perspective on literature and the arts that is so critical but often so neglected when talking about the debt. And then Sarah Molinari has been working with these directly with communities that are calling for a citizens edit. They are fighting for a just recovery now in Puerto Rico for about more than 2 years and is really attentive to those kind of social struggles on the ground too. And so those are things that complement the work that Yarimar and I are doing as well, right? But that we couldn't do this project in a full way without them, right? And so I think that has been something that's been really critical in our kind of formation of this collective that's trying to run this project, is really how to think kind of, you know, horizontally, and how to think in this kind of ways that are about kind of seeing all of the strengths that we're all bringing to this project as a way to get at the kind of deep complexities of the debt crisis.
Yeah, thank you so much for bringing their name and their work to this interview. That's really important. I was hoping that we could talk a little bit about, because you all have mentioned some sort of references to the debt or the canceling of the debt or certain things that have happened before Maria, right? And I think it's really important to say, and something that you all recognize in centralized in your introduction, is that Maria did not happen in a vacuum, right? The disastrous response by the Puerto Rican government and the United States government were in the making, right? So what happened after Maria, such as state failure, social abandonment, capitalization, collective trauma, were not simply because of Maria, right? But as you all write in the introduction, Maria revealed the systemic failures of Puerto Rico. And so I was wondering if you all could recount some of the history that could help contextualize the listeners to these failures.
So I think one of the things that we try to really centralize in our editor's introduction, but that I think all the pieces really point to, right, from the various contributors. And so it's interesting to think about this as a theme that actually runs and cuts across like genre or like approach, right? So you can find it in the poems, you can find it in the play, you find it in the photo essays, right? As much as in the journalistic or scholarly pieces, is really this idea of what in the introduction we call this the coloniality of disaster, right? So the fact that what sets the real kind of disaster that is occurring in Puerto Rico is one of colonialism, right? And colonial extraction and exploitation, right? And all of the ways in which that cuts across with racism, capitalism, all of these other kind of social structures, right? And so what we see is that, you know, Maria ends up becoming this event that opens up a lot of perspectives to reflect, right, on how this has been this longstanding disaster that's been building for you know, not just decades, but for centuries, right? And so that's something we really try to pull out in the editor's introduction, and which comes across in a lot of the pieces, right, is that this is not something that happened 2 years ago, right, but this is it's hard to tell if this is even like what the event we're talking about is, right? And so that's why we kind of draw on this concepts of aftershocks, right? Which Yadimar can kind of explain a little bit better than I can, right? But the concept of aftershocks is really just this question of like, what is the actual disaster, right? If we're talking about these compound effects, right? It becomes very difficult to distinguish whether we're talking about something that is an after effect, something that is a main shock, something that is a foreshock, what's setting the grounds, right? And so we have this really complicated and nonlinear history, right, that we try to trace in the book, right? Because it isn't just a straight line, right? There's a lot of zigzagging that has to do with the various machinations of how colonial rule and governance has functioned in Puerto Rico and the various ways in which people have resisted it, right? They have given birth to this current moment of crisis, right? Of which Maria is one effect, but we can also argue that Maria is actually an effect of the debt crisis, right? Which the debt crisis is an effect of the Commonwealth relationship, right, which gets established in 1952 in Puerto Rico, right? So it's very difficult to kind of trace this very straightforward genealogy. But the argument that we try to make that even though there isn't a clear cut kind of genealogy or line, right, we can trace a significant amount of what led to the present crisis in this day with Maria to these kind of systematic failures that have been fostered by an emphasis on colonialism and capital extraction. So I don't know if you want to kind of get into a little bit more about why aftershocks and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think I borrowed this term that's more related to earthquakes than hurricanes. And part of that might be because I was, you know, trained by a Haitianist, think a lot about Haiti, and was really impacted by the earthquake in Haiti in 2010. And that for me, that was one of the entry points for thinking about anthropology of disaster, et cetera. Mm. And so, and the other nod in that title is also to Naomi's shock doctrine. And so, but you know, and part of the dialogue that I have with Naomi Klein about this is that I don't know that the shock doctrine is the appropriate way to think about the what's happening in Puerto Rico, because there's not necessarily a shock, but a trauma, you know, and an aftershock. And so part of what we want to suggest is that it's hard to say what is the main shock and what are the aftershocks, what are the recursive disasters that are happening in Puerto Rico. Is Maria the main shock? And then, you know, all the problems with the recovery are the aftershocks that are being experienced, the blackout, the death toll, all of those can be thought of as aftershocks of Maria. But at the same time, Maria itself might be thought of as an aftershock related to the debt crisis, because, you know, the debt crisis set the stage for Maria to be as devastating as it was, as did climate change, mm-hmm. as did colonialism, as did all these other factors that are put into place. And part of what I find really interesting and evocative to think about in relationship to this idea, this concept of the aftershocks, is that scientists don't know exactly which is the main shock until, you know, a long period of time has passed. And so you might mm-hmm. feel something that you think is the main shock, and then it later turns out to be a foreshock, or it turns out to be the main shock, and then there's these other events. And I think that speaks to how people in Puerto Rico are feeling right now, where there are these repetitive hits to the collective body, and it's unclear where exactly it originates, and sadly, it's also unclear when exactly it's going to end. You know, so I think that that's the other issue, is that there's these feelings that there might still be more aftershocks. And mm-hmm. I remember in Haiti after the earthquake, a lot of people kept sleeping outside. They were afraid to go back into their homes because they were afraid of new jolts. And, you know, I think similarly in Puerto Rico, a lot of people are afraid of what's going to happen. You know, when is the recovery going to really take place? Yesterday in the newspaper, you know, they showed that 2 years after Maria, there's been no significant public works done to repair the roads, to repair the fallen bridges. You know, so there is this state of suspension still in Puerto Rico, where people are still waiting to see, you know, what is going to be the full extent and outcome of all of this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that we really tried to point to, and we do this with the story that we open up the introduction with, right, is really the idea that these jolts are also cumulative, right? So it becomes that, okay, maybe there are these really minor supposed aftershocks, right? But when you take all, you're dealing with shock after shock after shock, right? Impact after impact after impact. That has a cumulative effect that can sometimes make it worse than the actual initial shock, right? And so that's one of the things that we start off with this story of this woman who starts to experience significant mental health crisis after the hurricane, right? And it's not necessarily even the hurricane that is what is causing her mental health crisis, right? The way that she narrates it, and what we found really intriguing about her story, is she narrates it as this idea that, like, there's no jobs, I can't go back home, I'm dealing with this new kind of environment. And like, it becomes that what happens is that the hurricane starts to unleash this situation that then creates all of, as you noted, this repetitive or cumulative shocks, right? That actually are what creates this now bigger crisis, right? This worse crisis. So it's not just that she lost her house, or it's not just that she lost her job, right? But it's the cumulative things that come after that, right? That can sometimes create this situation that ends up becoming worse than the initial trauma, right? And so for us, that was something that was really critical to point to, also because so much of the response following Hurricane Maria was this need to get over it kind of quickly, right? And we talk about this idea of resilience. We have other kind of authors who talk about and challenge this idea of Puerto Rico se levanta and Puerto Rico rises, and all of this kind of these slogans that emerge in the aftermath of the hurricane, which were not take into account, right, the fact that there are these successive shocks, right? So to hear 2 years later that literally the front page of El Nuevo Día yesterday said $0 spent on public infrastructural works, right? And to just tell people that, oh, they're making a big deal out of it, or that was 2 years ago, you should get over it, doesn't take into account those long lasting and cumulative effects, right? And so that's something that in the book, we really tried to find contributors who were very attentive to that. And in our author, our editor's introduction, we tried to write something that they really tried to get at that, right? And so the concept of aftershocks allowed us to try and get at that in some ways.
Thank you. One thing that I really enjoyed about the book is that you and the contributors are really careful about which words you're using and sort of explore these words and all of their meanings, right? And so some of the words that I'm thinking about that you all just mentioned is something like, what does it mean for Puerto Rico to recover, right? What does it mean for people to be resilient? What does it mean for people to be able to take jolt after jolt after jolt, right? So I was wondering if you all can talk a little bit about some of those terms and how you all complicate them, not only in the introduction, editor's introduction, but Yarimad, in your conversation with Naomi Klein, or Marisol in your interview later on in the book.
Yeah, so, I think we wanted to think critically about first this notion of crisis as a kind of, and to question the temporality of this event, when it began, when it ended. And so, looking for, a kind of conceptual vocabulary that could allow us to unpack the temporality of this event. Also thinking critically about this idea of shock, of a kind of sudden blow. How can we think about the kind of long durée of what's happening in Puerto Rico? And then really complicating this idea of recovery. So first, on the one hand, saying, that they're there really is no recovery. There were things that were lost and loved ones that were lost to Maria that are never coming back. And then at the same time, we don't necessarily want to recover to where we were before Maria. We don't want to bounce back. And also we want to think critically about this idea of being resilient and being able to sustain shock after shock and to, bounce back to a situation that is not acceptable to begin with. Mm-hmm. And so part of what we discussed yesterday at the book launch also was how the government at times uses and promotes this narrative of resilience. And one of our contributors, Sofia Galliza Muriente, she was not able to be there last night, but she was watching on the live stream and she was texting me afterwards, reminding me about how also the governor used this pitch to try to sell Puerto Rico as a headquarters for Amazon. Also, saying, oh, we have, this resilient population. And also Puerto Rico, is sold as the best of both worlds, where you can pay, you can stamp your goods made in the USA. And, Amazon could have brought its headquarters there and say that it was in a U.S. territory, but still pay their workforce much less. They've been passing, even before Maria, labor reform to reduce wages, to curtail labor rights. And so, to think critically about what recovery means for the government and for certain economic interests that would like Puerto Rico to recover and become an even better colony, And so we don't, that's not necessarily what we want to see for Puerto Rico moving forward.
Yeah. And one of the things I think we try to be really attentive to is like also challenging this discourse of resiliency. Right. And, just this idea that like what exactly are Puerto Ricans supposed to be resilient to, right? There's not an effort by the government, as, the piece by Arturo Masol demonstrates, right, on the kind of solar and the lack of green and renewable energies, right, in Puerto Rico, right? There's no government effort to actually make the infrastructure resilient, to make the archipelago less vulnerable to the effects of climate change, which are going to increase in the Caribbean over the next years and decades, right, to make catastrophic events like Maria more and more common, right, which is what we've seen with Dorian most recently, right? So the resiliency is not about the things that are actually going to make people feel safer, right, and feel like more resilient in their environment, right? It becomes this kind of neoliberal individual responsibility kind of notion of being able to withstand these forms of state violence, right? And being able to kind of grin and bear it with these forms of extraction and exploitation that actually create the very conditions that make Puerto Rico less resilient when it comes to issues of climate change, right? And so these become really critical, kind of touchstones for us in the editor's introduction, but as well as in the pieces, and in particular in Yadimar and Naomi Klein's kind of conversation, right, around this desire for this kind of population that will be willing to take whatever people will throw at it, right? Because that's what it takes to actually get Puerto Rico to, quote unquote, recover from the economic debt crisis, right? And that's what we're seeing with the implementation of PROMESA, this implementation of the COFINA agreement, which is an agreement that which Ed Morales writes about in his piece, as well as Eva Prados and hers, right, which is basically rewarding vulture capitalists for buying Puerto Rican debt for pennies on the dollar, and then asking Puerto Ricans to pay over 11% in sales tax, right, which is sales tax that's now not going to go to schools, not going to go to basic infrastructure, not going to go to hospitals, right? And so you're demanding a kind of population that is going to be able to go without basic infrastructure and necessities, right? And that's what resilience becomes, right? And so we really try to challenge that, right? And kind of think about how do we go from, you know, resilience to questions of self-determination and sovereignty, right? Where's the kind of shift there? And so that's especially in kind of terms of trauma, right? We try to kind of really unpack those questions.
Yeah, and on that, the topic of resilience, I want to read a quote from page 32, and this is a quote from Yarimad in conversation with Naomi Klein, where Yarimad, you say, resilience suggests that business can carry on as usual, that Puerto Rico can be open for business even as thousands remain roofless, homeless, displaced, and destitute. In this way, resilience becomes jargon for simply adapting to rather than confronting or transforming unacceptable conditions, right? And so a discourse of resiliency sort of lets the state off the hook and makes room for these vulture capitalists, as you all say. And I think the relationship between self-resiliency and self-determination is incredibly important. And I'm wondering if you all can talk more about this idea or the conflict between self-reliance and self-determination. What does it mean to be self-reliant even under state abandonment? And then what does it mean to be self-determinant, right? Or what does it mean to be able to govern oneself?
Yeah. Thank you, John. Thank you for pulling that quote out. I have to say, it moves me. I don't know, like, so much of this is still so, you know, fresh. And you know, we're in the anniversary week of Hurricane Maria. And so, mm-hmm. I don't know, just hearing the echo of those words and the anger that I felt a year ago, as, you know, people who were still living under, you know, tarps and everything, we're being called upon to carry on as usual. And I should say, you know, we're seeing this again in the Bahamas, where already the Ministry yeah. of Tourism has called for tourists to come back and said, we need tourists. And they have people staying in luxury hotels. And then in order to feel better about it, they will like spend an afternoon making sandwiches with Chef Jose Andres while they're on their vacation, right? And so I think that, you know, there's lots of ways in which, you know, there's a particularity to Puerto Rico because of its relationship to the U.S., but I think it's important to think beyond that and to also connect it to the broader, you know, challenges of climate change and sovereignty in the Caribbean region as a whole. And so, and I wrote a column this week for El Nuevo Día, which is thinking about that and about how Puerto Rico's disaster, we see it play out in the kind of repeating islands of the Caribbean. But in terms of resilience and self-determination, I actually have new thoughts about that after this summer. I mean, already before that, I was writing about the tension between the government neoliberal calls for resilience and what you could see, you know, as a kind of challenge to Puerto Rico's colonial situation through grassroots calls for autogestión, or self-reliance, which I did see as something somewhat different from, you know, what the government was calling for. So, you know, before Maria, already with the debt crisis, there was a lot of talk about Puerto Ricans having to self-rely, to do things for themselves. And there are ways in which that lets the state off the hook. And there are ways in which it replicates a neoliberal ideology that a state is only there to really serve the markets and not really serve its populations. But we saw how this summer that kind of self-reliance and Puerto Ricans, you know, realization that they don't need the state, that the state is not really providing for them or looking out for them, led to them not being afraid of getting rid of their governor. And so there are ways I think that these calls for self-reliance and for resilience have actually, not worked out for the state, mm-hmm. but, you know, you know, not been what they've expected. And so I think that, it's tricky how, you know, when abandoned and left to their own devices, you know, then Puerto Ricans realize, well, maybe we can figure out other ways of doing this. And they already, you know, did a whole movement against the local governor. And who knows what's going to happen if FEMA and the federal government also keeps delaying, you know, the work that it's supposed to do. Because, you know, right now you drive through Puerto Rico and you see all these, street lights that aren't working and traffic lights that aren't working. And everyone says, oh, it's because, you know, they're waiting for FEMA. That's up to FEMA. So as if that explains why 2 years out, it's still not done. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think that the complicated politics of self-reliance and that are neither good nor bad, you know, it's not entirely neoliberal, but it's also not entirely anti-colonial. And so we have to be careful about romanticizing autogestión as well, you know, and remaining critical of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that I've been thinking about a lot over the past 2 years and have been talking to a lot of kind of collaborators and just, you know, colleagues and friends and folks who are kind of activists as well. And just trying to think about, you know, there's this way in which autogestión comes from this really rich tradition, right? If we think about kind of autonomous anarchist kind of politics, right, which is about like exactly decentering the state, right, which has, you know, this super, super rich kind of tradition in Puerto Rico, right? Although it's not often seen as, because of the kind of whitewashing of the anarchist tradition, is not seen as a central node, right, in kind of anarchist thinking and action. But one of the things for us to kind of consider is like, it comes out of these really rich traditions, like, you know, abolitionist politics, anarchist politics, kind of, you know, Black feminist kind of politics of kind of embodiment and self-determination, right? They are like inherently anti-colonial, inherently anti-capitalist, right? But there's a way in which there is a capability for the state to really grasp onto that, right? And also try to make it serve its ends, right? Which is not the intention of the activists themselves, right? Or the people who are lending support and solidarity, right? But there's a way in which the state is incredibly savvy at how to try and turn this into something to benefit it. And that's something that I've seen in the course of my own research on policing, right? Where there's this community, Loisa in Puerto Rico, that's a predominantly Afro-Puerto Rican community, low-income community. And whenever the police go in, they act super racist, they're very violent. And so the community was just like, we have this problem with gang violence and we're going to deal with this on our own. And they started doing direct mediation and working with like gang-involved youth, right? And in a lot of ways, that's exactly what the state wants to do, is like, let these communities deal with the problems on their own, right? And so that's what we started to see also as the debt crisis worsened, right? After Maria hit, right? The state is in a lot of ways totally content and happy not only to let these communities do this stuff on their own, but then to, in a really cynical way, be like, look at how strong our communities are. So for instance, in the case of the community in Loisa, which was the work of a feminist organization, Taller Salud, they were totally happy to say, we should do this Taller Salud program all over the archipelago, and we should use this as a model, right? And so there's a way in which the state pointing to that as a model is different from what the intention of that community is, because the state wants it to become a model so that they can start to retreat more and more and more from the expectations that citizens have for public safety, right? And so we started to see that a similar kind of move after Maria, I think, right, where the state was making these claims of like, look at our resilient population, look how, in San Sebastian, which is where my family's from, the power authority wasn't doing anything. And now all these retired line workers were able to restore power, right? That's amazing. That's the ingenuity of our people, right? And there's a way in which it becomes a cynical move that's actually about absolving the state and also attracting capital. So we just have to be very like mindful of the ways in which, even though these moves in and of themselves are not neoliberal, they can feed into this work that the state is doing to achieve these kind of neoliberal ends.
Thank you. Thank you so much, both of you. So we're sort of coming to the end of the conversation, but I wanted to ask, what are your hopes for the anthology and the broader PR syllabus moving forward? What are some things, you all talk so much about wanting, or how you all are public scholars and working with people outside of academia, and the accessibility of the anthology. What are some of your hopes for the anthology?
Well, the next step is to have it come out in Spanish. Mm-hmm. We've already contracted with Editorial Callejón in Puerto Rico, because, you know, even though we've already made sure that it's going to be available in English, going to be sold there, we also want to make sure that it's accessible in Spanish. So that's, you know, we're working on that. And then in terms of Puerto Rico syllabus, we have several plans to expand it. We want to make it fully bilingual. That's a goal that we've been working towards for a while. We've been applying for funds from the National Endowment for the Humanities and other sources to incorporate more undergraduates, you know, in it, and to find, we're still figuring out and, you know, open to suggestions and more, you know, more participation from other folks in the Puerto Rico syllabus of how to make it more than just a website, but actually a community of learning, you know, transnational, multilingual, and a kind of space where people can find, you know, alternative stories that you don't find in the mainstream media or even in mainstream academic organizations and conferences at times.
Yeah, I think our like big goal right now is just trying to figure out how to make this sustainable, right? And so that's been the challenge with the syllabus, right? And, you know, a lot of these projects are projects of love, right? So like this book came out in the past year and, you know, everyone kind of dropped stuff to keep up with a timeline to be able to make it possible for this book to come out so quickly, right? And to come out with, you know, I think, right, a high quality, you know, book, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that we have a similar kind of challenge with the PR syllabus as well, which is, this is something that, you know, we have full-time jobs, right? Our other two collective members are writing their dissertations, right, or doing research, right? And so this is something that folks are doing, because they feel really passionate and they think it's really important, but that creates this kind of workflow problem, right? That we've been trying to kind of figure out how to make this a sustainable project, right? Particularly because we do see this as a little bit different from traditional kind of digital syllabi, right? Which is like a kind of one and done deal, right? We see this as more of an ongoing kind of project that is about creating a kind of living archive of the debt, right? The debt crisis and the responses to it. So that's something that we've been trying to figure out as we're like applying for grants, as we're trying to work with kind of updating our website and stuff like that, how to make this a more sustainable project, right? That doesn't make us burn out or doesn't make us kind of feel like racked with guilt, which is kind of where we're at right now for not updating it for a while, right? And stuff like that. So so that's kind of what we're dealing with right now. And so we're hoping actually to be in conversation with also other kind of digital kind of scholarship folks about having these conversations about how to make these projects much more sustainable, right? Because it is often not the primary thing. It is also, unfortunately, the thing that is among the most devalued in academia, despite this kind of constant touting of the digital humanities, right? Like everyone wants like you to have in your CV or in your cover letter, right? For those of you who are listening to this on the job market, right? If you can point to having a DH component to your dissertation, right? Oh, that's very cool. But it literally counts for nothing often when you're going up for tenure or promotion. And so trying to have these conversations about like, how do we quantify the work that we're doing? How do we show the significance of the work that we're doing? So for me, you know, the Puerto Rico syllabus, and I'm sure Yadimar feels similarly, is just as important as the books we've published, right? I think it does an incredible service, and it is about creating knowledge communities in the same way that our kind of more traditional scholarship is as well, right? And so how do we communicate that, right? And help to kind of make that value real and legible within academia. And I think that's a big challenge that we're trying to figure out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you so much. And whether or not it's legible in academia, myself, and I'm sure many of the listeners and many of the non-listeners incredibly appreciate the work that you all do and that you all have done. And I want to continue to just stress the importance of this anthology, right? As we find ourselves at the 2-year anniversary of Hurricane Maria and in the midst of more natural disasters in the Caribbean and the greater Atlantic Ocean. And something that I wanted to just bring to the conversation, while we won't have much time to talk about it, is that the lived experiences of people in these disasters are vary, right? As you all mentioned in the NYU panel and in some spaces of the book in the anthology, that specifically, you know, Black Afro-Puerto Ricans, folks who identify as Black or queer, trans, and people of minoritized experiences experience disaster much differently, and experiences vary across the island and the archipelago. So I wanted to bring that to the conversation. In order to just for us to wrap up, one last thing I have to ask you all is, what are you all working on now? And that might seem daunting after sort of talking about everything you've worked on. But the listeners do like to sort of hear, what are future projects that authors are working on?
Well, I'm working on my my own book about Puerto Rico that I had started writing about the statehood movement in Puerto Rico. Then it also became about the debt crisis and the death of the ELA, and then about Hurricane Maria, and also about Ricky Renuncia. So a book that somehow encapsulates everything that's been happening in Puerto Rico for the last several years. And in addition to that, I also have another collection coming out next year called Trujillo Remixed, with basically a Michelle Roth Trujillo reader that is also the product of a conference that we did at the University of Chicago for the 25th anniversary of Silencing the Past, Trujillo's most notable book. So your listeners should definitely look out for that, although that is on an academic press, so it's on an academic timeline.
I am working on, let me see, what am I working on? So I'm at Harvard this year at the Warren Center. And so I'm on leave, for my kind of teaching responsibilities and stuff like that. So I'm actually trying to get a jump start on my next project, which is looking at Puerto Rican involvement, international solidarity and freedom movement. So for instance, how did Puerto Ricans show support for the anti-apartheid struggle or pro-Palestine, anti-occupation, anti-war movement in Southeast Asia. So looking at how Puerto Ricans throughout the 20th century aligned themselves with these international freedom movements, not only to show solidarity with these movements, but to also use those movements as an opportunity or to make legible Puerto Rico's ongoing colonial condition, right? So this becomes the ongoing struggle for Puerto Ricans, is like, in a decolonial world, how do you make it clear that Puerto Rico is still a colony, right? And so one of the arguments I'm making with this next project is actually that these international solidarity movements allow them to kind of make comparisons, right, that make Puerto Rico more legible on the international kind of stage. But I'm also working on, making waffles and exercising and plants, because my book just came out and then this book just came out. So I feel like I just have twins. So I'm kind of good for a minute, but I am, I do want to take advantage of this kind of opportunity and to kind of jumpstart this project, which I'm really excited about.
Thank you. Those all sound incredibly exciting. And Yarimar, you're like the master of turning conferences into like books. Like,
I don't like things to disappear. I like them to become something. Yes.
That's beautiful. Well, thank you all so much for talking to me and talking about the anthology and your work on the PR syllabus and the work that you are are doing this next year. And so I incredibly enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.